also use them to meet their dealers. Without legions of middle-class kids in cars, the Jalisco boys' business model didn't work. In cars, kids shot up, gave rides to fellow junkies, hid their dope. When their parents trusted them finally died, the kids lived in these cars, and the cars became their private bedrooms. As heroin and OxyContin addiction consumed the children of America's white middle classes, parents hid the truth and fought the scourge alone. They kept quiet. Friends and neighbors who knew shunned them. When your kid's dying from a brain tumor or leukemia, the whole community shows up, says the mother of two addicts. They bring casseroles. They pray for you. They send you cards. When your kid's on heroin, you don't hear from anybody until they die. Then everybody comes, and they don't know what to say. These parents made avoidable mistakes, and when a son died or entered rehab for the fourth time, they again hid the truth, believing themselves alone, which they were as long as they kept silent. This pervasive lie was easily swallowed. It often lay buried beneath lush lawns, shiny SUVs, and the bedrooms of kids who lacked for nothing. It was easier to swallow, too, because some of these new addicts were high school athletes, the charismatic golden youth of these towns. Athletes opened the door for other students who figured that if cool jocks were using pills, how bad could it be? One addict I met was Carter, from one of California's wealthiest communities, the son of a banker. Carter had been a high school star in football and baseball. With no break from sports during the year, he battled injuries that never healed. A doctor prescribed Vicodin for him, with no warning on what Vicodin contained or suggestions for how it should be used. Sports were king in Carter's town. It was a place of gleaming mansions, but he felt no sense that education was of value in providing choices in life, much less for the love of learning. These kids' futures were assured, so sports were what mattered. Dads would brag to friends about their sons' athletic exploits, then berate their boys for poor play, urging greater sacrifice. From the athletic director down to parents and teachers, they heard, "You need grades so you can play. That was the vibe we got," Carter told me. I saw this often. Many new athlete addicts were not from poor towns where sports might be a ticket out for a lucky few. The places where opiate addiction settled hard were often middle and upper middle class. Parents were surgeons and developers and lawyers and provided their kids with everything. Yet sports were as much a narcotic for these communities as they were to any ghetto. Love of learning seemed absent, while their school weight rooms were palatial things, and in many of them, pain pills were quietly commonplace. Just as opiates provided doctors with a solution to chronic pain patients, Vicodin and Percocet provided coaches with the ultimate tool to get kids playing again. Carter's coach told him stories of players years before gulping down Vicodin before practices and games. In my town, the stands were always filled. You wanted to be the hero, so you think, I can't look weak. I gotta push myself. I would get these small injuries. The coaches wouldn't pay any attention. I taught myself not to pay attention to any injuries. Most athletes on every team Carter played on use pills, for injury or recreation. Soon Carter grew addicted to Vicodin and then to OxyContin. From there, as a student athlete at a Division I university, he began using heroin. I was coming to see football players as symbols of this American epidemic. Their elevated status on campus left some of them unaffected by consequences. Carter was caught selling pills and was told not to do it again. Above all, though, players were in constant pain and expected to play with it. If opiates were now for chronic pain, well, football players endured more chronic pain than most. Necks, thighs, and ankles ached all season. Medicating injuries to get athletes playing through pain was nothing new. But as oxycodone and hydrocodone became the go-to treatment for chronic pain, organized sports, and football in particular, opened as a virtual gateway to opiate addiction in many schools. Thus, With the epidemic emerged the figure of the heroin-addicted football player. Though, of course, few wanted to talk too much about that. By 2008, when Joanna Crone's son died, these kinds of delusions had been accepted for almost a decade in places like Salt Lake, Albuquerque, Charlotte, Minneapolis, and other cities that had for the same decade been the drivers and beneficiaries of the greatest boom in the history of U.S. consumer spending. But it was in beat-down Portsmouth, Ohio, where one mother, and not the wealthiest in town by a long shot, had the gumption to own the truth and say something about it. Across Portsmouth, at the counseling center, Ed Hughes thought silence was a huge part of the story. Opiates had exploded all those plans Hughes had in the mid-1990s to consolidate the counseling center's operations and focus on improving its internal workings. The center opened years before in a small house. By 1992, it began residential treatment with 16 beds. When I met Hughes, the counseling center had 150 beds, a huge waiting list, a staff of close to 200, and had just moved its outpatient center into an abandoned three-story school, due entirely to the swarms of new opiate addicts. "We've never seen anything move this fast," Hughes told me. A decade and a half in, Ed Hughes was still waiting for the arc of addicted clients to plateau and curve downward. Kids were coming to the center from across Ohio. Many, he said, grew up coddled, bored, and unprepared for life's hazards and difficulties. They'd grown up amid the consumerist boom that began in the mid-1990s. Parenting was changing then, too, Hughes believed. Spoiled rich kid syndrome seeped into America's middle classes. Parents shielded their kids from complications and hardships and praised them for minor accomplishments, all as they had less time for their kids. "You only develop self-esteem one way, and that's through accomplishment," Hugh said. "You have a lot of kids who have everything and look good, but they don't have any self-esteem. You see 20-somethings, they have a nice car, money in their pocket, and they got a cell phone, a big screen TV. I asked them, 'Where the hell did all that stuff come from? You're a student.' 'My mom and dad gave it to me.' 'And you put opiate addiction in the middle of that?" He winced. Then the third leg of the stool is the 15-year-old brain. Hughes saw this all the time, too. Adult drug users incapable of making mature choices. This happened because opiates stunted the part of their brain controlling rational action. "We've got 25 to 30-year-old opiate-addicted people who are going on 15. Their behavior, the way their brain works, is like an adolescent," he said. "It's like the drug came in there and overwhelmed that brain chemistry and the front of the brain did not develop. The front of the brain has to develop through mistakes. But the first reaction of the addicted person is to head back to the family. 'Will you rescue me?' Whatever the person's rescued from, there's no learning. There's no experiences, no frontal brain development. They're doing well and then some idea comes into their head and they're off a cliff. It may not be a decision to use. Most relapse comes not from the craving for the drug. It comes from this whole other level of unmanageability, putting myself in compromising situations, or being dishonest, being lazy, being a 15-year-old. Hughes knew families as addicted to rescuing their children as their kids were addicted to dope. This, too, was an epidemic, Hughes believed. "I've got 40-year-olds who act like 22-year-olds because their families are so enmeshed in rescuing them. The parents are giving them a place to live, giving them money, taking care of things, worrying about them, and calling me trying to get them into treatment. I try to tell parents it's real important to say no, but say no way back when they're young." Most of these parents were products, as I am, of the 1970s, when heroin was considered the most vile back-alley drug. How could they now tell their neighbors that the child to whom they had given everything was a prostitute who expired while shooting up in a car outside a Burger King? Shamed and horrified by the stigma, many could not and did not. Opiate use in medicine had been destigmatized by crusading doctors But destigmatizing the new opiate addiction had no prestigious crusaders. That task fell to parents of dead kids and a few individuals with a flair for guerrilla political action, which is how I would describe Brad Belcher. I visited Belcher one night because he had kicked the shins of the status quo in his hometown of Marion, Ohio. Like Portsmouth, Marion once thrived. Power shovels built in Marion helped dig the Panama Canal. But those days and those jobs were gone. Inertia had replaced optimism. Decades into the decline, hundreds of Marion kids had grown addicted to pain pills and then switched to heroin. The Chamber of Commerce desperately devised slogans, "Downtown Marion, watch us grow." A casual observer could sympathize with Marion's city fathers. Like so many Midwestern towns, Marion was afflicted by forces that were awesome and unseen. A prolonged recession, the steady drip of jobs disappearing, had beaten at Marion. A lot of people with aspirations left. So too, Belcher felt, did any impulse to look at new ways of attacking problems facing the city. If you counted all the thefts, the drug dealing, the court cases, the hospitalizations, the pawns, the prison, and the people in jail, the town seemed to Belcher to be running on heroin. Yet the cops never appeared to make heroin arrests. The newspaper never mentioned it. Belcher, 28, with cropped hair and way of speaking, is a recovering drug addict. With 5 years sober, he had the kind of energy common to many in recovery, and chafed at Marion's apathy. One night it occurred to him to go online and order 800 large black signs with white letters proclaiming the insurgent message, "Heroin is Marion's economy." They arrived a week later. Late one foggy night, Belcher stuck those signs all over Marion, in cornfields, near the prison, outside churches, by bus stops, schools, and along streets in the better neighborhoods. "I was generally hoping for some kind of awareness, to get people talking about some kind of solution," he said. "It's in everybody's household." He was just about to put them up downtown that night when a police officer, a deputy sheriff, and a highway patrolman pulled him over. They roused the city attorney. Marion's city government mobilized that night to uproot Belcher's signs. Only 10 remained when Marion awoke. But then, a drug dealer put snapshots of the signs on Facebook. That created the effect Brad Belcher sought. The signs became the talk of Marion. Television reporters came. City officials held a town hall meeting. Cops began making heroin arrests, and the paper reported them. There was a march to City Hall. None of that solved the problem, of course, but it did get people talking, which Belcher took as a start. Another person I saw cutting through the silence surrounding opiates was Wayne Campbell, a barrel-chested guy with the personality of the football coach he was part-time. About a year after Joanna Crone in Portsmouth, Ohio, became likely the first parent in the country to raise her voice and organize in response to the opiate epidemic, Wayne Campbell followed suit in the Columbus suburb of Pickerington. Like Joanna's son, Wayne's oldest son, Tyler, had also played football. He was a safety for the Division I University of Akron Zips. In 2009, the school opened a 30,000-seat football stadium, a monument to corporate America in sports. The $61 million Infocision Stadium, named for a company that operates call centers, also has a field named for the Summa Health System, a nonprofit hospital, club seating named for First Merit Corporation, and a press box named for a local credit union. If ever the Division I school needed a good year from its team, 2009 was it. Instead, the team disintegrated under the pressure to win and the weight of pills. The Zip star quarterback that year, Chris Jackamane, grew addicted to OxyContin after suffering a separated shoulder. He began stealing and was expelled from the team early in the season, then left school. Jackamane's life spiraled down. He died of a heroin overdose 2 years later. Something like that happened to Wayne's son, Tyler. A walk-on and an eager and aggressive safety, Tyler Campbell was prescribed 60 Percocets after shoulder injury following the 2008 season. He was given no instructions about the drug and how to use it. Nor was it clear that he needed that many pills to recover from the surgery. Doctors told Wayne it was the usual post-surgical prescription. It seemed to Wayne that doctors wanted to make sure patients didn't return quickly, so they prescribed a lot. That was part of the problem, he figured. Wayne spoke later with Jeremy Bruce, a wide receiver on the team, who provided a glimpse of the team unraveling that year. The coaches and trainers, Bruce said, felt pressure to field a winning team as the school opened its new stadium. After the games, some of the trainers pulled out a large jar and handed out oxycodone and hydrocodone pills, as many as a dozen to each player. Later in the week, a doctor would write players prescriptions for opiate painkillers and send student aides to the pharmacy to fill them. I was on pain pills that whole season, hydrocodone or oxycodone. I was given narcotics after every single game, and it wasn't recorded. It was like they were handing out candy, Bruce told me. One problem the team faced was a steep drop-off in talent from the first to the second string, Bruce said. As first stringers got hurt and second stringers couldn't fill in, he said, it's a snowball effect because of the pressure and the stress just to get those first stringers back on the field. I think that's where the narcotics came into play, and that's why it was handed out so easily. The stress and the pressure to win right now. J.D. Brookhart, the team's head coach that year, said that he knew nothing of the extent of opiate dependence on the team that Bruce describes. That wasn't the case that we knew of, he said. I don't think it was anything that anybody thought was anything rampant at all, not from the level I was at. It's not like trainers or coaches had any authorization to prescribe pills. These pills were ordered by doctors. Injuries were the team's overriding issue that season, Brookhart told me from his home in Texas, where he has retired from coaching and now works for a Christian nonprofit. Some 24 players missed 8 or more games apiece due to injuries that year. This included 2 of Jacquemain's 3 backups, he said. By the end of the 2009 season, the Akron Zips football team was a poster squad for America's opiate epidemic. Not only was Jacquemain dismissed for issues related to his addiction, but as the season wore on and the injuries mounted, Bruce said, I would say 15 to 17 kids had a problem. It seems that most who had an addiction problem had an extensive problem with injuries as well. Toward the end of the season, he said, players had learned to hit up teammates who had just had surgery, knowing they would have bottles full of pills. Meanwhile, a dealer from off-campus sold to the players, visiting before practice sometimes, fronting players' pills and being paid for the monthly rent and food allowance that came with their scholarship. The 2009 Zips inaugurated the school's new stadium with only 3 wins that year. The coaching staff was fired at season's end, but the effect of the season lingered on. Among the team's weaknesses that year was its size on defense. Overall, its defensive line and linebacking core were small. So, too, were its cornerbacks. They could cover receivers well, but were unable to provide much help in stopping the offense's running attack. The team's lack of defensive size was felt acutely at one position, safety, Tyler Campbell's position. Running backs often broke through the defensive line and linebackers. It too often fell to safeties to make tackles. Against a monstrous Wisconsin team, the first game of the 2008 season, with a scholarship now and starting his first collegiate game, Tyler, for 1 week, was the nation's leader in tackles with 18, an exploit that coaches attributed to his hard work and perseverance. His stats, though, highlighted the team's weakness. When a safety is making that many tackles, Bruce said, there is a serious problem. Opposing running backs should never get to the secondary that many times. As the season went on, Tyler injured his shoulder. His body never fully healed, and he had surgery after the season. At the time of the surgery, a snowstorm hit Ohio, and his parents couldn't be with him in Akron to ensure he took the pills correctly. Team doctors could give Wayne no records of what Tyler was given after games. But those first 60 post-surgery Percocets, following the 2008 season, seemed to have begun his addiction. By the next season, Unbeknownst to those close to him, Tyler had transitioned to OxyContin. Tyler's 2009 season was spotty. He played 11 games but made only 31 tackles and grew secretive and distant, which teammates and family attributed to his play on the field. In the spring of 2010, his grades dropping and his behavior moody, Tyler was sent home. Over the next year, he was in rehab twice and relapsed. At some point, he switched to heroin. In June 2011, his parents put him in an expensive rehab center in Cleveland. 30 days later, he drove home with his mother, clean, optimistic, and wanting to become a counselor. The next morning, she found him dead in his bedroom of an overdose of black tar heroin from Columbus, likely hidden in his room from before he entered rehab, Wayne believes. With a solid reputation in Pickerington, Tyler's family had kept his addiction a secret. But when he died, Wayne told his wife, "Let's open it up. Come out and be honest." The Campbells had 300 wristbands made for the funeral. "Just say no" for TC. The obituary urged mourners to donate money to a drug prevention group. 1,500 people attended the memorial. As they consoled him, Wayne was struck by how many murmured in his ear, "We've got the same problem at home." 2 weeks later, Wayne met with fathers who wanted to do something in his son's memory. He knew few of them, but learned that several also had addicted kids. That marked a moment of clarity for Wayne Campbell. "When Tyler died, it lifted the lid," he said. "We thought it was our dirty little secret. I thought he was the only one. Then I realized, this is bigger than Tyler." From that grew a nonprofit called Tyler's Light. By the time I met Wayne Campbell, Tyler's Light had become his life's work, just as Joanna Crone was now devoted to Solace. He spoke regularly to schools about opiates, showing a video of white middle-class addicts, one of whom was the judge's daughter. Wayne invited others to join him. Among them was Gary Cameron, commander of the Columbus Police Department's narcotics unit. Cameron's team was fighting the Jalisco heroin networks crawling over Columbus. Meanwhile, as he told auditoriums full of school kids, his stepson was addicted to their heroin. Cameron viewed the Jalisco boys as a new vanguard in narcotics, resembling isolated terrorist cells more than a traditional trafficking organization. Most drivers, he noticed, really didn't know much about the drug they sold. They lived isolated in small apartments. No arrest slowed down these cells. Too many American kids were now hooked on opiates. Neither they nor their parents had much idea of what they were up against. So, in the time of the Jalisco boys, Gary Cameron viewed education as, fundamentally, police work. "We were quick to talk about the problems we associated with crack," Cameron said one day after a Tyler's Light presentation. "We just don't talk about heroin addiction." About a year after Wayne Campbell formed Tyler's Light, Paul Schoonover called. Could he and his wife, Ellen, help in any way? Schoonover asked. It had been a few months since the Schoonover's son, Matt, had died from a black tar heroin overdose the day after leaving 3 weeks of drug treatment. As I researched this story, the Schoonovers were among the first parents I met on my first trip to Columbus. The death of their son had come well into this epidemic, yet it had blindsided them. Until Matt's death, they knew nothing of it. So at the funeral, Paul stood and told hundreds of mourners the truth of how Matt had died, about the pill use, the OxyContin, then the heroin. He told them how through all this, Matt led a normal suburban life. He played tennis and golf. Most of his friends were goal-driven and making plans. Matt had goals, but had trouble following through to accomplish them. Still, he was working and part of the family. He never dressed shabbily, and though he ran out of cash quickly, he never stole from his parents. His bedroom door was always open. He never looked like what his parents imagined an addict to be. Yet all the while, it appeared, he led a dual life. "Was I seeing what I only wanted to see?" said Ellen later. "I might have been." Shortly after Matt's death, Paul and Ellen Schoonover attended the speech of a motivational speaker with a breakfast group of well-heeled middle-aged couples like themselves. The speaker that day asked them to imagine a second half of their lives about more than just enjoying what they'd accumulated. The question was, how do you take that second half of your life and make something significant from it? Paul said, when I met the couple in the office of their Columbus insurance agency. Maybe not a lot of people come to that question. I don't know that I would have. We knew what we were going to do. Matt's death had led them there. The Schoonovers took it as a calling. They once thought addiction was a moral failing, and now understood it as a physical affliction, a disease. They had thought rehabilitation would fix their son. Now they saw relapse was all but inevitable, and that something like 2 years of treatment and abstinence, followed by a lifetime of 12-step meetings, were needed for recovery. After kicking opiates, it takes 2 years for your dopamine receptors to start working naturally, Paul said. Nobody told us that. We thought he was fixed because he was coming out of rehab. Kids aren't fixed. It takes years of clean living to the point where they may have a chance. This is a lifelong battle. Had we known, we would never have let Matt alone those first few vulnerable days after rehab. We let him go alone that afternoon to Narcotics Anonymous, NA, his first day out of rehab. He had his new clothes on. He looked good. He was then going to play golf with his friend. Instead of making a right turn to go to the meeting, he made a left turn, and he's buying drugs and dying. When you start into drugs, your emotional development gets stunted. Matt was 21, but he was at the maturity level of middle teen years. Drugs take away that ability to act emotionally mature. The drug becomes your god. The speaker's question that day prompted the Schoonovers to channel their grief. Too many parents were as lost as they'd been. So Paul called Wayne Campbell, hoping to use Matt's story to sound the alarm and prepare parents for what awaited them. There was so much evil in all of this, said Ellen Schoonover. We will turn that into something good. We can embrace it and find meaning from Matt's death. Part 4. America. 5 years after I stood on that Ohio River bank in Huntington, West Virginia, wondering what I was onto, the victims of America's opiate scourge had emerged from the shadow and the silence. They were everywhere now, and known to be so. Heroin had traveled a long way from the back alleys of New York City and William Burroughs Junkie. It was even, I discovered as my story wound down, in the upscale pseudo-Spanish subdivisions of terracotta tile and palm trees in Southern California, not far from where I lived, especially there. A half hour from my house, the town of Simi Valley agonized over a spate of opiate overdose deaths, 11 in a year. Simi Valley, conservative and religious, had long been an enclave for cops. Many LAPD officers live in the town. Simi's vice mayor is a Los Angeles police officer. So for years, Simi was one of America's safest towns. According to the crime statistics, it still is. But with pills everywhere and heroin sold in high schools, its kids were now also dying of dope. Simi youth clogged the methadone clinics. Nearby Thousand Oaks, Moore Park, and Santa Clarita told similar stories. Low crime and high fatal overdose rates. This was the new American paradigm, a happy surface over an ominous reality. We came to this safe city and were doing everything society's asked us to do, and yet here we are burying our kids, said Susan Klamusko, whose son, Austin, died from a heroin overdose. Klamusko and others in Simi formed a coalition to fight back. Not One More, supported by the city council and the town's retail core, Starbucks, California Pizza Kitchen, Home Depot, Subway, and others. Yet these were times when heroin was still invisible, conveniently hidden away, at least to anyone who wasn't a junkie or a parent of one. Then on Super Bowl Sunday, 2014, America awoke to the news that one of its finest actors was dead. Philip Seymour Hoffman, 46, was found that morning in his Greenwich Village apartment, a syringe in his arm and powder heroin in packets branded with the Ace of Spades near his corpse. Blood tests showed he had heroin in his system, combined with cocaine, amphetamine, and benzodiazepine. The Oscar-winning actor, a father of three, had checked into rehab the previous May for 10 days, and then, pronouncing himself sober again, left to resume a hectic film schedule. Just as the death of Rock Hudson 30 years ago forced the country to recognize AIDS, Hoffman's death awoke it to the opiate epidemic. Within days, media outlets from coast to coast discovered that thousands of people were dying. Heroin abuse, the news reports insisted, was surging. Almost all the new heroin addicts were hooked first on prescription painkillers. This was not new. It had been happening for 15 years. And there was more to it than drugs. This scourge was, I believed, connected to the conflation of big forces, of economics and marketing, of poverty and prosperity. But this was tough to articulate in 4-minute interviews, and a lot of it got lost in the media's rush to discover the new plague. Attorney General Eric Holder described an urgent and growing public health crisis and called on police and paramedics to carry naloxone, an effective antidote to opiate overdose. By then, though, a lot about this story had already been changing. 2 decades into the pain revolution, a consensus had emerged that opiates were unhelpful, even risky, for some varieties of chronic pain, back pain, headaches, and fibromyalgia among them. Several clinics and doctors I spoke with had policies against using them for those ailments. One 2007 survey of studies of back pain and opiates found that use disorders were common among patients, and aberrant use behavior occurred in up to 24% of the cases. It was unclear, the authors found, whether opiates had an effect on back pain in the long term. By the end of the 2000s, it was already common for people to go from abusing OxyContin to a heroin habit. Purdue Pharma recognized this, and in 2010 reformulated OxyContin with an abuse deterrent, making the drug harder to deconstruct and inject. The intent was to make Oxy less abusable. It did. Had the company done this in 1996, our story might have been different. But now, there was a swollen population of OxyContin addicts nationwide. Without Oxy, they flocked to heroin in even greater numbers. Fast food restaurants developed a heroin problem. Across the country, people were using their convenient bathrooms as places to shoot up. There, locked in isolation, many overdosed and died. In Boston, the problem got so bad that the city's public health commission asked fast food workers to do periodic bathroom checks and began training workers to notice the signs of overdose, a person's slowed breathing or lips turning blue. Alabama now had heroin. Mississippi and southern Louisiana did too. Rural towns in Indiana and Oregon were bad. Eastern Idaho, North Dakota, and Wyoming were too. West Virginia saw fatal heroin overdoses triple in 5 years. Cable County, where Huntington is located, had the highest number in 2012, with 26 people dying from too much heroin. Local media from upstate New York and Minneapolis ran large and continuing stories about heroin. The Albuquerque Journal reported an 80% increase in heroin use in New Mexico. The Ohio River Valley and Salt Lake City were swimming in it. Heroin was all over New Hampshire and Vermont. And Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin dedicated his entire 2014 State of the State speech to the new plague. Heroin had spread to most corners of the country because the rising sea level of opiates flowed there first. The story resembled the heroin scourge a century before, ushered in on the prescription pads of physicians, the vast majority of whom were sincere in intent. Drug traffickers only arrived later and took far less profit than did the companies that made the legitimate drugs that started it all. What started as an OxyContin and prescription drug addiction problem in Vermont has now grown into a full-blown heroin crisis, Governor Shumlin said. What made New York City the dominant heroin market for so much of the 20th century? Its vast number of addicts, its immigrants, and its proximity to poppy-growing countries was now true of most of America. Most of the country's heroin was coming from Mexico, and thus through the Southwest, trucked into New York, not arriving on ships from Asia. New York functioned now as more of a regional hub than the nation's central heroin distribution point it once was. The pharmaceutical industry's sales force arms race ended. Pfizer, Merck, Lilly, and others laid off thousands. One U.S. trade publication suggested that 2014, with sales rep employment down from 110,000 people to 60,000 nationwide, might be the year when the pharma salesperson really begins his slow walk to extinction. Patents on blockbuster drugs had expired. The image of sales reps walking the halls of hospitals and medical offices, cornering doctors with the opportunity to present, respond, and close the deal, is very likely going to be limited, the article lamented. The arms race left behind massive lawsuits and criminal cases for misbranding and false advertising. Purdue was hardly the only company to have been sued. Its $634.5 million fine was soon dwarfed. Pfizer alone paid more than $3 billion in fines and legal penalties to settle lawsuits alleging, among other things, the misbranding and false advertising of several drugs. That included $2.3 billion to settle a criminal suit in 2009, alleging the company illegally marketed its blockbuster painkiller, Bextra. The sum was the largest criminal fine of any kind, though it amounted to less than 3 weeks of the company's sales, the New York Times observed. Various agencies had tempered their initial enthusiasm where opiate pain treatment was concerned. The JCAHO was now promoting multidisciplinary approaches to pain, including more healthy behavior, psychological support, and non-opiate medications, along with the education of patients on the addiction risks of opiates. So presumably Vicodin and similar drugs would no longer be prescribed without a word as to what they contained. The FDA was now requiring drug companies to provide patients and doctors with education on addiction risks from timed-release opiate painkillers, a common-sense extension of the patient's rights movement, though one that came inexplicably late. The FDA, meanwhile, reclassified Vicodin from a Schedule III drug to a more restrictive Schedule II. It also denied approval of a generic timed-released form of oxycodone, a no-name OxyContin. But then it approved Zohydro, a timed-release pill similar to OxyContin, containing as much as 50 milligrams of hydrocodone per pill, though without acetaminophen or anything else to deter abuse. The agency's own advisory committee of pain specialists recommended against Zohydro and was overruled. Purdue followed that with an announcement that the company would soon seek FDA approval for its own timed-release hydrocodone pill, though this one would include an abuse deterrent. The FDA approved another Purdue drug, Targenique ER, which combines timed-release oxycodone with naloxone, the opiate overdose antidote. OxyContin sales, meanwhile, kept rising. Within a few years of the criminal case brought against the company by John Brownlee's prosecutors in Abington, Virginia, Fortune reported, Purdue was selling $3.1 billion worth of the drug a year. At the same time, though, many doctors now seemed to eschew opiate painkillers as energetically as they had embraced them a few years before. Patients who truly needed a low-dose opiate treatment for their pain were having difficulty finding anyone to prescribe it. Primary care docs still didn't have the time, and many hadn't the preparation, to effectively treat chronic pain patients. That wasn't about to change. In fact, fewer medical students were going into primary care, repelled by long hours, the modest money, and the lack of respect. One study estimated the country would need 52,000 more primary docs by 2025. A commentary by four doctors and researchers in the American Journal of Public Health in September 2014 insisted that it is difficult to believe that the parallel rise in prescriptions and associated harms is mere correlation without causation. Also, it is difficult to believe that the problem is solely attributable to patients with already existing substance abuse disorders. They went on, appropriate medical use of prescription opioids can, in some unknown proportion of cases, initiate a progression toward misuse and ultimately addiction. Even if an initial exposure is insufficient to cause addiction directly, perhaps it is sufficient to trigger initial misuse that could ultimately lead to addiction. Pain may well help lessen the euphoria of opiates, as the pain crusaders had contended. Yet the authors noted how little was known about pain and addiction, both enormously complicated topics. Medicine still lacked the tools, they wrote, to identify who was at risk of addiction from properly prescribed opiate painkillers, nor was there much knowledge of how, in treating pain, to balance that risk with the benefit of relief in patients showing signs of sliding into abuse of those drugs. What little knowledge existed, moreover, had not made it into medical school training, certainly not to the degree that the pain crusaders, aided by drug companies, had changed medical school curriculum with selected evidence of the benefits of opiate painkillers, the authors wrote. After more than a decade, in which chronic pain was treated with highly addictive medicine, there was still no attempt to bring the studies of pain and addiction together. Specialists in pain and in addiction operated in different worlds. They appeared not to know each other socially. They saw the same patients. A pain patient now might soon be an addict, after all. But there were no conferences where they shared ideas. No journal combined both specialties. Nor could I find any study that attempted to measure this crucial question: how many people grew addicted to pills they were prescribed? I felt for doctors. Prescribe, and they risk the patient growing addicted. Don't prescribe, and a patient may have to live with crushing pain. Patient evaluations nipped at their heels. It was a minefield. No wonder so few young doctors were going into primary care. Multidisciplinary pain clinics were seeing a rebirth, however. Their menu of services had been shown to help many chronic pain patients over time. Agencies with a financial interest in their patients' long-term improvement were turning to it. Above all, the Veterans Health Administration, once a promoter of opiate therapy for chronic pain, had been turning around. Pain as the fifth vital sign was no longer gospel. Opioids are an effective pain medication. They do work, but a pill is just not always the answer, said Dr. Gavin West, a top VHA clinician. After years of watching too many vets with chronic pain become bedeviled by addiction as well, the VHA was opening multidisciplinary pain clinics. The clinics included physical therapy, acupuncture, massage, and swimming pool therapy, as well as social workers and psychological counselors to help vets suffering chronic pain also find work and housing and resolve marital problems. The VHA has 70 of these clinics around the country, as I write. The numbers of their high-dose opiate patients have fallen dramatically. The goal was to get patients back on their feet, going to work in their kids' soccer games. To do those things, you have to approach the patients holistically. We not only have a financial stake, but an ethical stake in this too, West said. We're lucky, though. We have the advantage of taking the long view. A lot of insurance medical systems don't have that. They'll pay for what helps a person over a couple years. What happens in 10 years is probably the next insurance company's problem. If your economic driver is, I'm going to see a patient for 10 minutes and bill them, that's a bad driver. People who can take a long view are at an advantage to treating a patient holistically. Insurance companies, notably, have not found the same virtue in multidisciplinary care. But the VHA has figured a more balanced approach to pain will improve patient function while lowering treatment costs in the long run. Their clients, after all, will be with them forever. I never was able to speak with Russell Portnoy. In an email, he politely declined my interview request. However, weeks before that, a remarkably frank interview with him was included in a video released by PROP, Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. In the interview, Portnoy acknowledged that as he urged the more liberal use of opiates for chronic pain, he gave many lectures to primary care doctors, citing Porter and Jick and several other papers. None of the papers, he said, represented real evidence, and yet what I was trying to do was to create a narrative so that the primary care audience would look at this information in toto and feel more comfort about opioids in a way they hadn't before. In essence, this was education to destigmatize opioids, and because the primary goal was to destigmatize, we often left evidence behind. Clearly, if I had an inkling of what I'd known now then, I wouldn't have spoken in the way that I spoke. It was clearly the wrong thing to do, and to the extent that some of the adverse outcomes now are as bad as they have become in terms of endemic occurrences of addiction and unintentional overdose deaths, it's quite scary to think about how the growth in that prescribing, driven by people like me, led, in part, to that occurring. The treatment is you. Washington State. Out in Washington State, Jamie Mai and Gary Franklin continued chronicling the effects of what Franklin called the worst man-made epidemic in history, made by organized medicine. Washington addicts and treatments for opiates had skyrocketed through the 2000s, from about 600 to a conservatively estimated 8,600 by 2010. Most were young, suburban, and white. Overdose deaths in the state rose to 512 in 2008. In 2008, L&I issued its guidelines to doctors, aimed to limit opiate prescribing. Overdose deaths had declined since then, and by 2012, they stood at 388. The numbers of injured workers dying from overdoses, which had so startled Jamie Mai years before when she was new to her job, had kept rising, up to 32 in 2009. But since the prescribing guidelines came out, the number had been cut in half. So too had the number of injured workers who ended up as chronic opiate users. I went up to Seattle, where the multidisciplinary pain center traced its lineage back to John Bonica, the former pro wrestler and pain pioneer. Dr. David Taubin was now its director. Years ago, Taubin was an eager opiate prescriber. He taught the purported message of Porter and Jick. He cheered the introduction of higher-dose OxyContin. Then he watched patients fail to improve. They became disgruntled, demanding ever higher doses. During these years, he remembered an applicant to the center's pain fellowship program who was asked why he wanted the post. "I want a Bentley," the applicant replied. "That, to me, is a metaphor for where pain management is," Taubin told me. Having changed his mind about opiates, Taubin came to work at the clinic when Alex Kahana took over. Kahana's new approach was to try to get back to the old approach, treat the social and psychological roots of pain along with the biological. The center staff now included two psychiatrists, three psychologists, a vocational counselor, as well as doctors in family, internal, and rehab medicine. A generation of doctors had been urged to consider pain the fifth vital sign. "It's just wrong," Taubin said. "I'd say 15% of my patients are probably much better off by being on opiates, but at low or moderate doses." Taubin took over for Kahana in 2013. Kahana's 5 years at the center immersed him in America's pain culture wars. The experience had made him something of a philosopher of pain and happiness. Kahana believed that what insurance companies reimbursed for distilled many unfortunate values of the country. "We overtest, perform surgery, stick needles. These people are worse off," he said. "If we work on their nutrition, diet, sleep habits, smoke habits, helping them find work, then they improve. You have to be accountable. If you give a treatment that kills people or makes people worse, you gotta stop. You can't continue making money on stuff that doesn't work." Kahana saw stuff as the problem. Our reverence for technology blinded us to more holistic solutions. "We go to the moon, invented the internet. We can do anything. It's inconceivable to think there are problems that don't have a technological solution. To go from, I can do anything, to, I deserve everything, is very quick. All of a sudden, we can't go to college without Adderall. You can't do athletics without testosterone. You can't have intimacy without Viagra. We're all the time focused on the stuff and not on the people. I tell pain patients, forget all that. The treatment is you. Take charge of your life and be healthy and do what you love and love what you do. And he ignored that very advice. Kahana came to Seattle at 260 pounds and gained 45 more over the next 5 years as, stressed and overworked, he battled to rebuild the historic clinic. The clinic won numerous awards, was highlighted as a model. He was on CNN and in People magazine, gave a TED talk, and testified before the U.S. Senate on overprescribing in medicine. He grew fatter all the while. He was taking medications for hypertension, cholesterol, and then more for the side effects from the medication. 9 pills a day, $1,500 a month in copays. I couldn't walk 2 flights of stairs without huffing and puffing, he said. His own doctor was about to prescribe something for elevated blood sugar when Kahana had enough. He seemed to be living like an addict. He had spent years trying to change public policy, influence academia, and shape legislation on the overprescribing of pills for pain. Now he decided to become the change. He resigned from the clinic. He is now a consultant to low-income communities on health issues. He went on a regimen of healthy eating and daily training of running, strength conditioning, and yoga. His pills became gradually unnecessary. He lost 110 pounds and runs marathons. The U.S. medical system is good at fighting disease, Kahana believes, and awful at leading people to wellness. They don't know how to do it, and the path they offer actually makes people worse. In 2013, the committee that John Rockefeller Jr. formed to search for the holy grail of a non-addictive painkiller turned 75. Its annual conference was at San Diego's Bayfront Hilton, under impossibly azure June skies. The seminars took place in darkened conference rooms. Speakers presented data in voices muted by thick carpets. I attended because I wanted to understand what had become of the search for the Holy Grail. The search for a non-addictive alternative to opiates had a fairly spotty historical record. It had produced drugs, many of which were once believed, incorrectly, to be non-addictive. Demerol, nalbuphine, Tylenol. But this was the oft-repeated story, as humankind sought heaven without hell. The companies that first manufactured heroin thought it was non-addictive, and marketed it that way. 100 years later, so did the company that made OxyContin. Maybe this was just nature's way of saying that we can't have it all. The committee was now known as the College on Problems of Drug Dependence. It had expanded, and more CPDD researchers studied addiction treatment. At the conference, I had a beer with Andy Koop, the University of Maryland chemist, who was nice enough to take the time to explain his fascination with the morphine molecule and how it worked. Drugs that contain variations on the molecule were damned good at being painkillers, he said. We are working to find other drugs that are as good, without the undesired effects. My call is it's not going to happen. We've been using morphine clinically for 100 years, and we'll be using it 100 years from now. I'm not going to say it's never going to happen, but I don't see how it's going to happen. Then, as if thinking out loud, he added, if we could only stop the euphoria but not the analgesia, I think we would actually have what I would call the Holy Grail. Among the conference throngs was Martin Adler, a professor of pharmacology at Temple University. Adler had been a member of the CPDD since the 1960s. Virtually all of us, and certainly me, believe the chances of finding the Holy Grail drug are slim to none, Adler told me. People keep looking and industry keeps looking. I asked Adler if he thought such a drug was even desirable. Can humans handle having it all? After all, Americans had it all for a brief time, and many of the kids who benefited most from the country's embarrassment of riches had turned to drugs used to numb pain. Perhaps not, Adler allowed. Morphine was, he said, a great metaphor for life. The bad effects of morphine act to minimize the use of the drug, which is a good thing. There are people born without pain receptors. Living without pain is a horrible thing. They die young because pain is the greatest signaling mechanism we have. Adler believed the lesson of the last 15 years was that the conception of pain needed to change. "I don't think you're going to find one treatment for pain," he said. "You don't use one drug to treat all cancers. If you do, it's because you don't know how to treat each cancer specifically. I think where we're headed is to find the most effective treatments for different kinds of pain, chronic back pain, neuropathic pain. We just don't know enough about them. That may be because pain isn't a single disease. The body is incredible," he went on. "The most amazing thing we can imagine. What you do learn is that there is nothing that's so isolated from everything else that you can just attack that. Everything is tied to everything else. When you're dealing with the brain, they all intersect." I called Nathaniel Katz, the pain specialist in Boston. In the year since his patient Peter's death and his encounter with Peter's sister, Katz had come to see the foibles of human nature at work in all this. "My instructors told me that when you take opioids for pain, you can't become addicted, because pain absorbs the euphoria. That was at Harvard Medical School. It was all rubbish, we all know now. Why do we listen to those messages? Because we wanted them to be true." I told him I had spoken with people who pointed to Foley and Portnoy's 1986 paper in the journal Pain, and then to Portnoy's funding from pharmaceutical companies, including Purdue Pharma, as he traveled the country urging doctors to adopt a new view and use of opiate painkillers. These critics saw the potential for a conflict of interest. One of them was Andrew Kolodny, a physician who watched the epidemic unfold from his addiction specialty in Brooklyn. Kolodny later co-founded Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing, an organization of doctors critical of the new opiate prescribing. Portnoy starts lecturing around the country as a religious-like figure, Kolodny said. The megaphone for Portnoy is Purdue, which flies in people to resorts to hear him speak. It was a compelling message. Docs have been letting patients suffer. Nobody really gets addicted. It's been studied. Purdue created organizations that were meant to look grassroots. They gave loads of money to front organizations, which approached state medical boards about liberalizing regulations for prescribing. Every effort to control the problem, if it ended in less prescribing. You had all these groups saying what you're going to do is bad for pain patients. You now have an industry of pain specialists, and this is their business model. They have a practice of patients who will never miss an appointment and who pay in cash. The whole thing is really outrageous. Katz, however, saw another story at work. Katz admired Portnoy, who, he said, had spent a career searching for better ways to relieve his patients' real and considerable pain. Portnoy had helped make pain a topic of research. Moreover, Portnoy was always clear that pain treatment needed balance and time. Doctors needed to be selective in the patients who received this treatment. "But people want simple solutions," Katz said. "People didn't want to hear that, and the commercial interest didn't want to emphasize that." Meanwhile, Katz said, physicians everywhere faced insistent patients who felt entitled to relief. "You're standing there with keys to the opioid cabinet. Suffering is certainly real," he said. "For years, the doctor has had to say, 'I wish I could give them to you, but they're addictive. You can overdose. I want to, but I can't.' The keys to the kingdom were there, but the doctor as gatekeeper could not in good conscience open them." In this context, Portnoy and Foley's 1986 paper became influential because, Katz said, it was telling doctors what they already wanted to hear. "Your patients are suffering. Aren't we so much smarter than scientists of many years ago? Now we know that if you take opioids for chronic pain, you can't get addicted." You had a new priesthood that emerged, a priesthood of prescribing opioids for chronic pain, and a small number of pharmaceutical companies collaborating with these doctors. These companies had these tools, these new drugs. Doctors were being told by the mechanics, the pain specialists, that the tools worked. I think it's more useful to look at people as fundamentally reasonable, looking at why they did the things they did. You had a whole bunch of reasonable people doing what they thought reasonable, and it didn't work well. As Kat spoke, I thought back on all I'd heard and seen and thought it remarkable that all this could be part of the story behind why a town in Nayarit, Mexico, was now selling gobs of heroin in some of the wealthiest and safest places in America. I told him that I thought it just as bizarre that all that reasoning he referred to could, in some measure, hinge on the misinterpretation of a one-paragraph letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine in January 1980, written by Dr. Herschel Jick, who intended nothing of the sort. Porter and Jick is amazing for the absence of information in it, Kat said. But that paragraph gives you relief from your inner conflict. It's like drinking from the breast. All of a sudden, the comfort washes over you. The Internet of Dope, Central Valley of California. I might be down in Mexico next time you come through, the man said to me one morning as I sat again in his living room in California's Central Valley. He slouched in his easy chair, skullcap over gray hair, smiling hazily through the anemia, a once handsome face now pale and without the bronze gleam it once possessed. He stared out the screen door of the home his family bought for $22,000 years ago, and onto the streets of cracked asphalt, prim lawns, and working-class stucco houses. We'd spoken for hours on my visits over many months since his release from the years of prison that he served for his part in Operation Tar Pit. He had a gripping story of how heroin dealers from one small Mexican town spread black tar to new markets across the United States. I spent hours in his presence, listening to his faint voice speak slowly of the past. Much of what he said I knew to be true or found ways of confirming. His knowledge of Jalisco was detailed. So, too, his knowledge of methadone clinics in cities of America. The rest sounded entirely plausible. But in the underworld, as many people want to exaggerate what they've done as want to hide it. So I didn't know what to believe until I tracked down a DEA agent who'd worked Operation Tar Pit from the beginning. He confirmed the man's role, which he knew from listening to endless hours of wiretaps. He expanded the organization's network into other cities, especially into cities where there wasn't any competition, the agent said. He would target methadone clinics, where they'd find a client base and build upon it. Now, 15 years later, the crews the man had set up were still dealing misery. Countless young men from Jalisco, Nayarit were doing long federal prison terms. Jalisco avoided the notice of Mexico's drug cartels for a long time. After all, what did cartel traffickers care about crews that sold a kilo of heroin at a time? In 2010, however, the Zetas and the Sinaloa cartel went to war in southern Sinaloa. The violence spread south and engulfed tiny Jalisco, Nayarit. The results were predictable. Dead bodies appeared here and there. In one shootout, 11 people were killed, including José Luis Estrada, known as El Pepino, the Cucumber, a reputed local drug boss. Jalisco officials spoke of canceling the Feria del Elote, and the State Department warned Americans against traveling to Tepic. Cell leaders, who'd already been moving to Guadalajara, moved there even faster. They kept a low profile and couldn't live in the houses they'd spent so much heroin money building. This went on for more than a year, until it appears the Zetas triumphed. Cell leaders began paying protection to the cartel, and things calmed down. The flow of Jalisco black tar into the cities of America never slowed, however. East of the Mississippi, Jalisco drivers tormented Nashville, Memphis, Indianapolis, several cities in South Carolina, Cincinnati, Charlotte, and, of course, Columbus, and the suburbs for miles around each city. In Florence, Kentucky, narcotics officers arrested a cell of Sanchez family operators, including one local woman who'd been a go-between for the family in Nashville during Operation Black Gold Rush in 2006. The cell had been using only local white drivers to deliver heroin, providing them with cars and cell phones, presumably because it could no longer find laborers back home to do the job. Apparently, a rumor spread around Jalisco that the Commonwealth states, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Massachusetts, had more lenient drug laws. Several Jalisco drivers had been arrested in Weymouth, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston. The boys remained decentralized, resilient, and adaptable. They embodied America's opiate epidemic. They were quiet, nonviolent. They focused on new opiate markets where the only customers they wanted were the white people. They were, it seemed to me, the internet of dope. A drug delivery system for the 21st century, working in as many as 25 states, and all of this coming out of one small town in Mexico. These drivers had their own addiction nipping at their heels. It was the ranchero's dream to return home a king, to pay the banda, to dance with the girls, to see other men's envy, and to feel the embrace of their families as they opened boxes containing precious Levi's 501s and designer jeans. Meanwhile, the local government noted in a report that Jalisco was the 111th wealthiest of Mexico's 2,445 counties, municipios. The Jalisco crews owed a good part of their success to the prescription pill addiction that was now in every corner of the United States. Whether any of them knew this was an interesting question. I knew drivers who'd never heard the name OxyContin. This made sense to me. They spoke no English and socialized only with other drivers. I spoke, though, with Harry Sommers, the DEA honcho who coordinated the tar pit investigations years before. Maybe the Jalisco peons knew nothing, Sommers said. But, he told me, we know from information provided by members of these Nayarit networks and other intelligence that some of them were well aware of painkiller abuse and targeted areas where they believed it was rampant, and knowing those areas would be fertile ground for their product. Whatever the Jalisco boys knew, the way they flogged black tar heroin early on, combined with the aggressive marketing of pain pills in virgin territories then forming into the OxyContin belt to create catastrophic synergy, and presaged the transition from pills to heroin that would happen in the rest of the country years later. Kids who started on the pill ended up alone and dead in their cars, slave to a molecule. The forces set up to insist people consume it were as relentless as the molecule itself. Pills had been prescribed with wanton carelessness. Then black tar heroin from the Nayarit Mountains was sold to them like pizza. More and more parents continued on without their children. They suffered pain as chronic and life-mangling as any of those doctors and Purdue Pharma decided should be treated with opiate pills. A lot was changing for the Jalisco boys. By 2014, heroin trafficking was expanding dramatically across America, with new dealers, many of them addicts, getting in on the action every day. None had the Jalisco boys' franchised heroin delivery system. Nevertheless, they gnawed at markets the boys had been cultivating for years, and they found new ones full of pill addicts ready to switch. The potency of brown powder heroin from other regions of Mexico and sold by black gangs out of Detroit and the East Coast was getting stronger. The Sinaloa cartel seemed to have massively upped its heroin exports to Chicago and New York City and elsewhere. Heroin seizures at the U.S.-Mexico border had risen sixfold since 2007. Back in Jalisco, meanwhile, an incipient avocado industry was overtaking sugarcane and coffee and providing work for many. The industry dates to about 2009, when growers from the state of Michoacán, Mexico's avocado center, brought money and partnered with local farmers to plant avocado orchards. By 2014, those orchards were bearing fruit. The coffee warehouse where David Tejeda was gunned down was now an avocado warehouse. Many of the young men who applied for jobs were those who'd been arrested and served prison terms in the United States for selling heroin. Now with a criminal record, they faced lengthy prison terms if they were caught again up north. So they were turning to work in the avocado industry. Still, the town continued to live from tar heroin revenue in one way or another. Hundreds, perhaps even thousands of men from Jalisco County had gone north to sell heroin. Cars with U.S. license plates were common around town. Mostly they bore plates from California, Ohio, North Carolina, Utah, Colorado, and Oregon. And many of the vehicles had been used to hide and move large amounts of cash back home. Yet few men from Jalisco seemed substantially better off. Cell owners did well. But heroin cell workers remained tied to a cycle of boom or bust, spending money with ostentation, then having to return to the U.S. to work some more. In the Landarena,